Chapter 37 Fires in Cairhien. Egwene returned a graceful nod to the respectful bow of the ship's crewman who padded past her barefoot on his way to pull a rope that already seemed taut, possibly shifting a trifle the way one of the big square sails set. As he trotted back toward where the round-faced captain stood by the tillerman, he bowed again, and she nodded once more before returning her attentions to the forested Cairhien shore, separated from the Blue Crane by less than 20 spans of water. A village was sliding past, or what had been a village once. Half the houses were only smoldering piles of rubble with chimneys sticking starkly out of the ruins. On the other houses, doors swung with the wind, and pieces of furniture, bits of clothing and houseware littered the dirt street, tumbled about as if thrown. Nothing living moved in the village except for one half-starved dog that ignored the passing ship as it trotted out of sight behind the toppled walls of what appeared to have been an inn. She could never see such a sight without a queasiness settling in her belly, but she tried to maintain the dispassionate serenity she thought an Aes Sedai might have. It did not help much. Beyond the village a thick plume of smoke was rising into the sky, 3 or 4 miles off, she estimated. This was not the first such plume of smoke she had seen since the Arinen began to flow along the border of Cairhien, nor the first such village. At least this time there were no bodies in sight. Captain Elisor sometimes had to sail close to the Cairhienan shore because of mudflats. He said they shifted in this part of the river, but however close he came, she had not seen a single living person. The village and the smoke plume slipped away behind the ship, but already another column of smoke was coming into view ahead, further from the river. The forest was thinning, ash and leather leaf and black elder giving way to willow and white wood and water oak, and some she did not recognize. The wind caught her cloak, but she let it stream, feeling the cold cleanness of the air, feeling the freedom of wearing brown instead of any sort of white, though it had not been her first choice. Yet dress and cloak were of the best wool, well cut and well sewn. Another sailor trotted by, bowing as he went. She vowed to learn at least some of what it was they were doing. She did not like feeling ignorant. Wearing her great serpent ring on her right hand made for a good deal of bowing with a captain and crew born mainly in Tar Valon. She had won that argument with Nynaeve, though Nynaeve had been sure she herself was the only one of the three of them old enough for people to believe she was Aes Sedai. But Nynaeve had been wrong. Egwene was ready to admit that both she and Elaine had received startled looks on boarding the Blue Crane that afternoon at South Harbor, and Captain Elisor's eyebrows had climbed almost to where his hair would have begun, had he had any. But he had been all smiles and bows.
"An honor, Aes Sedai! 3 Aes Sedai to travel on my vessel? An honor indeed! I promise you a quick journey as far as you wish, and no trouble with Cairhien and brigands. I no longer put in on that side of the river, unless you wish it, of course, Aes Sedai. And Doran soldiers do hold a few towns on the Cairhienan side. An honor, Aes Sedai."
His eyebrows had shot up again when they asked for just one cabin among them. Not even Nynaeve wanted to be alone at night if she did not have to be. Each could have a cabin to herself at no extra charge, he told them. He had no other passengers, his cargo was aboard, and if Aes Sedai had urgent business downriver, he would not wait even an hour for anyone else who might want passage. They said again that one cabin would be sufficient. He was startled, and it had been plain from his face that he did not understand. But Chin Elisor, born and bred in Tar Valon, was not one to question Aes Sedai once they made their intentions clear. If two of them seemed very young, well, some Aes Sedai were young. The abandoned ruins vanished behind Egwene. The column of smoke grew closer, and there was a hint of another much further still from the river bank. The forest was turning to low, grassy hills dotted with thickets. Trees that made flowers in the spring had them, tiny white blossoms on snowberry and bright red sugarberry. One tree she did not know was covered in round white flowers bigger than her two hands together. Occasionally a climbing wild rose put swaths of yellow or white through branches thick with the green of leaves and the red of new growth. It was all too sharp a contrast to the ashes and rubble to be entirely pleasant. Egwene wished she had an Aes Sedai to question herself right then, one she could trust. Brushing her pouch with her fingers, she could barely feel the twisted stone ring of the Turangrial inside. She had tried it every night but two since leaving Tar Valon, and it had not worked the same way twice. Oh, she always found herself in Telairan Riod, but the only thing she saw that might have been any use was the Heart of the Stone again, each time without Sylvie to tell her things. There was certainly nothing about the Black Aja. Her own dreams, without the Turangrial, had been filled with images that seemed almost like glimpses of the unseen world. Rand holding a sword that blazed like the sun, till she could hardly see that it was a sword, could hardly make out that it was him at all. Rand threatened in a dozen ways, none of them the least bit real. In one dream he had been on a huge stones board, the black and white stones as big as boulders, and him dodging the monstrous hands that moved them, and seemed to try to crush him under them. It could have meant something, it very probably did, but beyond the fact that Rand was in danger from someone, or to someone's, she thought that much was clear, beyond that she simply did not know. "I cannot help him now. I have my own duty. I don't even know where he is, except that it is probably 500 leagues from here." She had dreamed of Perrin with a wolf and with a falcon and a hawk, and the falcon and the hawk fighting, of Perrin running from someone deadly, and Perrin stepping willingly over the edge of a towering cliff while saying, "It must be done. I must learn to fly before I reach the bottom." There had been one dream of an Aiel, and she thought that had to do with Perrin too, but she was not sure, and a dream of Min, springing a steel trap but somehow walking through it without so much as seeing it. There had been dreams of Matt, too, of Matt with dice spinning round him. She felt she knew where that one came from. Of Matt being followed by a man who was not there. She still did not understand that. There was a man following, or maybe more than one, but in some way there was no one there. Of Matt riding desperately toward something unseen in the distance that he had to reach, and Matt with a woman who seemed to be tossing fireworks about. An illuminator, she assumed, but that made no more sense than anything else. She'd had so many dreams that she was beginning to doubt them all. Maybe it had to do with using the Turangrial so often, or maybe with just carrying it. Maybe she was finally learning what a dreamer did. Frantic dreams, hectic dreams, men and women breaking out of a cage, then putting on crowns, a woman playing with puppets, and another dream where the strings on puppets led to the hands of larger puppets, and their strings led to still greater puppets, on and on until the last strings vanished into unimaginable heights. Kings dying, queens weeping, battles raging, white cloaks ravaging the two rivers. She had even dreamed of the Shan Chan again, more than once. Those she shut away in a dark corner. She would not let herself think of them. Her mother and father, every night. She was certain what that meant, at least, or thought she was. "It means I'm off hunting the Black Aja, and I do not know what my dreams mean or how to make the fool Turangrial do what it should, and I'm frightened and homesick." For an instant she thought how good it would be to have her mother send her up to bed, knowing everything would be better in the morning. "Only mother can't solve my problems for me anymore, and father can't promise to chase away monsters and make me believe it. I have to do it myself now." How far in the past all that was now. She did not want it back, not really, but it had been a warm time, and it seemed so long ago. It would be wonderful just to see them again, to hear their voices. "When I wear this ring on the finger I choose by right." She had finally let Nynaeve and Elaine each try sleeping one night with the stone ring, surprised at how reluctant she had been to let it out of her own hands, and they had awakened to speak of what was surely Telairan Riod, but neither had seen more than a glimpse of the Heart of the Stone, nothing that was of any use. The thick column of smoke now lay abreast of the Blue Crane, perhaps 5 or 6 miles from the river, she thought. The other was only a smudge on the horizon. It could almost have been a cloud, but she was sure it was not. Small thickets grew tight along the river bank in some places, and between them the grass came right down to the water except where an undercut bank had fallen in. Elaine came on deck and joined her at the rail, the wind whipping her dark cloak as well. She wore sturdy wool, too. That had been one argument Nynaeve won. Their clothes. Egwene had maintained that Aes Sedai always wore the best, even when they traveled. She'd been thinking of the silks she wore in Tel Iran Riod. But Nynaeve pointed out that even with as much gold as the Amarlin had left in the back of her wardrobe, and it was a fat purse, they still had no idea how much things would cost downriver. The servants said Matt had been right about the civil war in Cairhien and what it had done to prices. To Egwene's surprise, Elaine had pointed out that Brown sisters wore wool more often than silk. Elaine had been so eager to be away from the kitchen, Egwene thought, she would have worn rags. I wonder how Matt is doing. No doubt trying to dice with the captain for whatever ship he's traveling on.
Terrible, Elaine murmured. It is so terrible.
What is? Egwene said absently. I hope he isn't showing that paper we gave him around too freely. Elaine gave her a startled look and then a frown.
That?
She gestured toward the distant smoke.
How can you ignore it?
I can ignore it because I do not want to think of what the people are going through, because I cannot do anything about it, and because we have to reach Tyr. Because what we're hunting is in Tyr. She was surprised at her own vehemence.
I can't do anything about it, and the Black Aja is in Tyr.
The more she thought of it, the more certain she became that they would have to find a way into the heart of the stone. Perhaps no one but the High Lords of Tyr were allowed into it, but she was becoming convinced that the key to springing the Black Aja's trap and thwarting them lay in the heart of the stone.
I know all of that, Egwene, but it does not stop me feeling for the Cairhienan.
I have heard lectures about the wars Andor fought with Cairhien, Egwene said dryly.
Bene Sedai says you and Cairhien have fought more often than any two nations except Tyr and Ilion.
The other woman gave her a sidelong look. Elaine had never gotten used to Egwene's refusal to admit she was Andoran herself. At least, lines on maps said the Two Rivers was part of Andor, and Elaine believed the maps.
We have fought wars against them, Egwene, but since the damage they suffered in the Aiel War, Andor has sold them nearly as much grain as Tyr has. The trade has stopped now. With every Cairhienan house fighting every other for the Sun Throne, who would buy the grain, or see it distributed to the people? If the fighting is as bad as what we've seen on the banks, well, you cannot feed a people for 20 years and feel nothing for them when they must be starving.
A grey man, Egwene said, and Elaine jumped, trying to look in every direction at once. The glow of Saidar surrounded her.
Where?
Egwene took a slower look around the decks, but to make sure no one was close enough to overhear. Captain Elisor still stood in the stern by the shirtless man holding the long tiller. Another sailor was up in the very bow, scanning the waters ahead for signs of submerged mud banks, and two more padded about the deck, now and again adjusting a rope to the sails. The rest of the crew were all below. One of the pair stopped to check the lashings on the rowboat tied upside down on the deck. She waited for him to go on before speaking.
Fool, she muttered softly. Me, Elaine, not you, so don't glower at me like that.
She continued in a whisper.
A grey man is after Matt, Elaine. That must be what that dream meant, but I never saw it. I am a fool.
The glow around Elaine vanished.
Do not be so hard on yourself, she whispered back. Perhaps it does mean that, but I did not see it, and neither did Nynaeve.
She paused. Red-gold curls swung as she shook her head.
But it doesn't make sense, Egwene. Why would a grey man be after Matt? There is nothing in my letter to my mother that could harm us in the slightest.
I do not know why, Egwene frowned. There has to be a reason. I am sure that is what the dream means.
Even if you are right, Egwene, there is nothing you can do about it.
I know that, Egwene said bitterly. She did not even know whether he was ahead of them or behind. Ahead, she suspected. Matt would have left without any delay.
Either way, she muttered to herself, it does no good. I finally know what one of my dreams means, and it doesn't help a hemstitch worth.
But if you know one meaning, Elaine told her, perhaps now you will know others. If we sit down and talk them over, perhaps...
The blue crane gave a shuddering lurch, throwing Elaine to the deck and Egwene on top of her. When Egwene struggled to her feet, the shoreline no longer slid by. The vessel had halted, with the bow raised and the deck canted to one side. The sails flapped noisily in the wind. Chin Elsinore pushed himself to his feet and ran for the bow, leaving the tillerman to rise on his own.
"You blind worm of a farmer!"
he roared toward the man in the bow, who was clinging to the rail to keep from falling the rest of the way over.
"You dirt-grubbing git of a goat! Haven't you been on the river long enough yet to recognize how the water ruffles over a mudflat?"
He seized the man on the rail by the shoulders and pulled him back onto the deck, but only to shove him out of the way so he could peer down over the bow himself.
"If you've put a hole in my hull, I will use your guts for caulking!"
The other crewmen were clambering to their feet now, and more came scrambling up from below. They all ran to cluster around the captain. Nynaeve appeared at the head of the ladder that led down to the passenger cabins, still straightening her skirts. With a sharp tug at her braid, she frowned at the knot of men in the bow, then strode to Egwene and Elaine.
"He ran us onto something, did he? After all his talk of knowing the river as well as he knows his wife, the woman probably never receives as much as a smile from him."
She jerked the thick braid again and went forward, pushing her way through the sailors to reach the captain. They were all intent on the water below.
There was no point in joining her. "He will have us off faster if he's left to it." Nynaeve was probably telling him how to do the work.
Elaine seemed to feel the same way from the rueful shake of the head she gave as she watched the captain and crewmen all turn their attention respectfully from whatever was under the bow to Nynaeve. A ripple of agitation ran through the men and grew stronger. For a moment the captain's hands could be seen waving in protest over the other men's heads, and then Nynaeve was striding away from them. They made way, bowing now, with Elisor hurrying beside her and mopping his round face with a large red handkerchief. His anxious voice became audible as they drew near.
"A good 15 miles to the next village on the Andor side, Aes Sedai, and at least 5 or 6 miles downriver on the Kyrian side. Andoran soldiers hold it is true, but they do not hold the miles from here to there."
He wiped at his face as if he were dripping sweat. "A sunken ship," Nynaeve told the other two women. "The work of river brigands, the captain thinks. He means to try backing off it with the sweeps, but he does not seem to think that will work."
"We were running fast when we hit, Aes Sedai. I wanted to make good speed for you."
Elisor rubbed even harder at his face. He was afraid the Aes Sedai would blame him, Egwene realized.
"We are stuck hard, but I do not think we are taking water, Aes Sedai. There is no need to worry. Another ship will be along. 2 sets of sweeps will surely get us free. There is no need for you to be put ashore, Aes Sedai. I do swear it by the light."
"You were thinking of leaving the ship?" Egwene asked. "Do you think that is wise?"
"Of course it's..."
Nynaeve stopped and frowned at her. Egwene returned the frown with a level stare. Nynaeve went on in a calmer tone, if still a tight one.
"The captain says it may be an hour before another ship comes along, one with enough sweeps to make a difference.
Or a day. Or 2, maybe. I do not think we can afford to waste a day or 2 waiting. We can be in this village, what did you call it, Captain? Jureen? We can walk to Jureen in 2 hours or less. If Captain Elisor frees his vessel as quickly as he hopes, we can reboard then. He says he will stop to see if we are there. If he does not get free, though, we can take ship from Jureen. We may even find a vessel waiting. The captain says traders do stop there because of the Andoran soldiers."
She drew a deep breath, but her voice grew tighter.
"Have I explained my reasoning fully enough? Do you need more?"
"It is clear to me," Elaine put in quickly before Egwene could speak. "And it sounds a good idea. You think it is a good idea too, don't you, Egwene?"
Egwene gave a grudging nod.
"I suppose so."
But Aes Sedai, Elisor protested. At least go to the Andor bank. The war, Aes Sedai. Brigands and every sort of ruffian, and the soldiers not much better. The very wreck under our bow shows the sort of men they are.
We have not seen a living soul on the Carian side, Nynaeve said. And in any case, we are far from defenseless, Captain. And I will not walk 15 miles where I can walk 6.
Of course, Aes Sedai. Elisor really was sweating now. I did not mean to suggest... Of course you are not defenseless, Aes Sedai. I did not mean to suggest it.
He wiped his face furiously, but it still glistened. Nynaeve opened her mouth, glanced at Egwene, and seemed to change what she had intended to say.
I'm going below for my things, she told the air halfway between Egwene and Elaine, then turned on Elisor. Captain, make your rowboat ready.
He bowed and scurried away even before she turned for the hatch, and was shouting for men to put the boat over the side before she was below.
If one of you says up, Elaine murmured, the other says down. If you do not stop it, we may not reach Tyr.
We will reach Tyr, Egwene said, and sooner once Nynaeve realizes she is not the wisdom any longer. We are all... She did not say accepted. There were too many men hurrying about. On the same level now. Elaine sighed. In short order, the rowboat had ferried them ashore, and they were standing on the bank with walking staffs in hand, their belongings in bundles on their backs, and hung about them in pouches and scripts. Rolling grassland and scattered copses surrounded them, though the hills were forested a few miles in from the river. The sweeps on the blue crane were cutting up froth, but failing to budge the vessel. Egwene turned and started south without another glance, and before Nynaeve could take the lead. When the others caught up to her, Elaine gave her a reproving look. Nynaeve walked staring straight ahead. Elaine told Nynaeve what Egwene had said about Matt and a gray man, but the older woman listened in silence and only said, "He'll have to look after himself," without pausing in her stride. After a time, the daughter heir gave up trying to make the other two talk, and they all walked in silence. Clumps of trees close along the riverbank soon hid the blue crane, thick growths of water oak and willow. They did not go through the copses, small as they were, for anything at all might be hiding in the shadows under their branches. A few low bushes grew scattered between the thickets here close to the river, but they were too sparse to hide a child, much less a brigand, and they were widely spaced.
"If we do see brigands," Egwene announced, "I am going to defend myself. There is no Amarlin looking over our shoulders here."
Nynaeve's mouth thinned.
"If need be," she told the air in front of her, "we can frighten off any brigands the way we did those white cloaks, if we can find no other way."
"I wish you would not talk of brigands," Elaine said. "I would like to reach this village without—"
A figure in brown and gray rose from behind a bush standing by itself almost in front of them.